Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. Of all the grunge bands to emerge from the fertile Seattle scene about 25 years ago, Alice in Chains stood out for its mix of hard-driving rock and affecting harmonies. Despite Nirvana's reputation as a groundbreaker, it was Alice in Chains that was the first to go national. As it often does in music, however, success brought problems. Drugs, canceled tours, and tragic deaths. All of this makes for compelling reading in the first proper biography of the band, Alice in Chains, The Untold Story, by David DeSola, who also charts the group's unexpected resurgence over the past decade. David DeSola, welcome to the Roundtable.
Thank you for having me.
Why did you want to write about Alice in Chains, and what was it about the story that you were interested in finding out about?
Well, the impetus for this book was about 4 years ago. I was doing grad school at Georgetown and working at 60 Minutes, and that meant that I had a lot of reading and work to do at home. So one of those late night, you know, reading and work sessions, I put on the Dirt album for the first time in a very long time. And after I finished hearing it all the way through, I had the idea of looking for, I'm thinking somebody had already written a biography of Alice, and I went looking for one and didn't find anything along the lines of what I was looking for. So at that point, I had the crazy idea that I could do it myself. And as far as what drew me to it, I think, first of all, I think the music was, at the end of the day, we're talking and people know about them and care about them because of their music, not because of, you know, their drug problems or whatnot. So that was part of it. But also part of it was how they chose to function, or they tried to carry on despite some considerably difficult circumstances, and how they chose to carry on with a new singer despite, you know, losing somebody with a voice as unique and a presence as unique as Lance Daly's.
Now, this was an unauthorized book. The band did not really cooperate with you. How did that complicate the reporting and writing of it?
That's correct. The band, the management, the record label had no involvement with it. The only downside to that was that certain people would not talk to me. Certain potential sources declined to be interviewed if it wasn't an authorized biography, but I was able to work around it because you know, several other people I was able to talk to, many of them who knew them personally and professionally from over the years, were willing to talk to me on the record, and also because the band members themselves have been public figures for about 25 years now, give or take. So that means they have an extensive paper trail, if you will, of interviews from television, radio, print. So I went through this extensive archive of clippings and anything I could get my hands on, and so I cited them extensively. So even though I didn't get to speak to them, they are able to tell their story and their views and their experiences in their own words from things that I was able to find in the public record.
How were they able to be first out of the gate in terms of the commercial success? What was the timeline like for that?
Alice signed the record deal in 1989. Facelift was released in August of 1990, and they toured for about 8 months. The first single was We Die Young, and they got play on, like, you know, alternative and heavy metal programs and radio, but it didn't really launch them, so to speak. They made the video for Man in the Box in December of 1990, and when MTV put that song in heavy rotation, they went from having sold about 40,000 records in 6 or 8 months to sold in excess of 500,000 copies by the end of the summer, by, I believe it was September of 91. So that was the same. So even though Soundgarden had already put out an album before them, and they'd had a video on MTV, but, you know, they didn't get that kind of massive breakout success that Alice did. And keep in mind that Alice got their platinum record, you know, a month after Pearl Jam's 10 came out, and the same month that Nirvana's Nevermind came out. Obviously, those two albums raised the bar commercially quite significantly.
Before we get into some of the sadder parts of this story, let's talk a bit about the music. What do you think made the spark work so well? I mean, obviously, Cantrell, great songwriter, guitarist, Lane Staley had a unique voice. But what was it about, you know, getting these four guys together that made something bigger?
Sort of interesting. I mean, I think the voice, the vocals are a big part of it. I mean, the idea of Jerry and Lane sort of singing together and making, you know, two voices as one, something much bigger than the sum of the parts, some of the components. So that was just a very unique thing. I mean, I'd almost compare them to, you know, Simon and Garfunkel in that respect.
Like the coldest winter chill, heaven beside you, heaven with you. Like the coldest winter chill.
On the other hand, you know, Jerry is a, you know, very talented, very solid guitar player and songwriter. And sonically, they sort of go across the board from, you know, very heavy riffs to, you know, very heavy riffing like Black Sabbath to, you know, more country, more acoustic-oriented material. The sonic palette varies. I think the subject material also, you know, sort of resonated. I mean, they very much were a product of their time and their environment. And I think their sound and their subject material reflects that.
This was not something I realized, I think, at the time, but almost at the beginning of it, heroin got into the picture, right? It was like 1991 already?
91, you were correct. So I spoke to almost every producer and engineer that they ever worked with. Everyone who was involved with Facelift said there was no heroin at the time, and when they were making that album from 1989 to 1990. And on those early tours in support of Facelift, again, no evidence of heroin there. The best evidence I've been able to find is that in the fall, I guess it's late summer or fall of 91, when Alice in Chains were opening for Van Halen, that is when Lane was introduced to heroin. That was something that would be an issue with him and within the band, you know, right up until his death 11 years later.
But eventually, the band would find new life. A singer, William Duvall, stepped in, had been an Alice in Chains fan, and really, who wasn't from that generation? What do you make of the band in its current form?
I thought William was an interesting choice. He was an inspired choice, not a derivative one. William had his own upbringing and identity outside of Seattle. I mean, he came up in the Atlanta punk and hardcore scene. He sounds great. I think he's very comfortable and very confident stepping into some very, very big shoes. He doesn't try to be Lane, even though that's the standard he's held to. He's perfectly confident and fine being himself. And I think, you know, it was an unorthodox, but it ultimately a good choice for them.
What do you think the group's legacy is? I know you write a bit about their chances to get into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and it's been 25 years now, obviously. But going forward, you know, the band's got some new albums. They're still out there on the road. What do you think their legacy is?
I think they'll be remembered, and they are, and they will be remembered as, well, you know, one of the premier, the unique, and most influential American rock bands, grunge bands, metal bands, whatever label you want to use, of that era. It's interesting. I mean, Seattle in the late 80s and early 90s is one of those few times where a scene from a particular city has actually sort of dominated popular culture, at least for a brief period. And, you know, nobody planned it that way. It just sort of happened on its own in a very sort of organic and spontaneous manner. And Alice were one of the bands that were at the forefront of that. And there are plenty of bands that have come up in the years since who have cited them as an influence in some shape or form. So I think their legacy is secured. It's unfortunate that, you know, Lane and Mike Starr, the founding bass player, passed on due to their drug complications, and they're not around to enjoy it and to carry it on. But I think people will remember Alice in Chains long after that band has stopped recording and touring.
We've been speaking with David DeSola, the author of Alice in Chains, The Untold Story. David, thank you so much for your time, and really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.